And we took this opportunity to get in an eminent speaker to give us all an overview. So it's my pleasure to introduce Rob Thacker. He's a professor at St. Mary's University. He tells me he's acting associate dean of science, but he's glad that's going to end soon. He's also director of the Science Outreach Centre, which is more important in my opinion. The big job he has at the moment is he's CASCA president, and that means he is the co-chair of the Coalition for Canadian Astronomy, and that means he has the very important job of helping to lobby the government on behalf of astronomy. In terms of this talk, he led the midterm review in 2015 of Canadian astronomy, and so that's the reason and the ideal reason that he's the person to give us the overview of Canadian wide-field astronomy.
Thanks, Rob.
Can I just ask a quick question? Who in here is not actually at the conference and is just here for the talk? Okay, so this talk is actually for you, right? All of my colleagues are going to be like, yeah, know that. So this is, I didn't know quite what to call the talk. I was wondering whether I should irreverent or whether I should say sassy, but I've gone with cheeky because I'm English. So. And the reason why I've done this is because, to be completely frank, being the lead author on one of these reports is quite a stressful thing. You have to deal with people who, while not necessarily taking a gun out and wanting to shoot you, are upset with things that you say. You have to represent the views of the whole committee, right? And they may not even necessarily be your own views as well. That can be a little bit of a challenge sometimes. So what I'll try and do is sprinkle in a lot of stuff that's really about the organization of astronomy in Canada, and in particular, some personal thoughts upon that. So just a bit about what I do. Always dangerous to having a theorist talking about astronomy. I still haven't figured out what a star really is yet. So I actually do simulation work. I have really cut my teeth learning how to do large n-body simulations, which 20 years ago were useful for figuring out where galaxies were. Now they're completely useless, right? Because we've gone so far beyond looking at galaxies as point particles. And so that's the kind of stuff I do. This is actually one of my own simulations, and you've seen all of this stuff before. And so today, seeing as I'm at Perimeter, I thought I'd use a famous Feynman quote, three easy pieces. And so I'll stick together the whys with a lot of commentary on how we do science in general. I think that's kind of important, especially for wide field. There's a real kind of tension between wide field versus other types of telescopes. And then where we are at the present, this is interesting. Things are really changing for Canadian astronomy, right? And I think we just need to take a step back and look at how they've changed. And then I'll give a few sort of thoughts about the future, and particularly the next long-range plan. That's Karl Popper, right? So there is this big question that if you go to university and you take a course on philosophy of science about discovery-based versus hypothesis-based science. Now, a lot of the time, when you do really detailed particle physics work, you're really doing hypothesis-based science, whereas when you come into astronomy, I came from doing initially semi-classical quantum gravity. And so I came into astronomy from that, and I was kind of had that particle physics mindset to a certain extent. And then I'm on a panel with a bunch of people and saying, well, what's our hypothesis? And they're like, no, we just point the telescope and we find cool stuff, right? And that kind of took me by surprise because I was imagining there was some great hypothesis behind that. And what you find is, down the line, of course, there are always hypotheses behind it. And in fact, that's the only way you tend to be able to get money at the end of the day. So while I sort of racked my brains thinking, how do we reconcile this? The answer is don't sweat it, right? I mean, a lot of philosophers get very concerned about this, but it really doesn't matter because as long as good science gets done at the end, that's what matters. And so why I've mentioned this is because there is this really interesting interplay between statistics and phenomenology, especially in astronomy. I mean, this could be from psychology, right? But when you look at how things progress in astronomy, this kind of looks like this perfect circular sort of way. We do statistical studies initially. We find all of this from the ensembles. We start building our initial concepts of what the theory is. Then we develop the theory. And then we realize, oh, the statistics aren't good enough. We've got to go and look at individual things like galaxies. Got to understand the outflows coming out of the galaxies. What's the velocity structure and things like that. And so then you have refinement, and then you kind of go back, and once you've got a lot of those galaxy properties pinned down, then you need to get better statistics. It's never that clean. Never, ever that clean, right? But as a working hypothesis for how things evolve over time, it's really useful. So you wind up realizing that you do need both statistics and detailed individual object studies, right? These are naturally complementary, and one of the reasons why wide field is so important in astronomy. So if I was giving a science overview, I'd have literally a whole hour devoted to all of the amazing science that we could do over the next sort of like 10 years or so. I'm not going to do that primarily because that's the point of this meeting, right, to talk about the possibilities there. But no one can deny that there is a tremendous amount of interest in exoplanets right now. Regardless of what your personal views are on that, there's a huge amount of interest in that, especially from the public. Star and planet formation continue to be these things that we're wrestling with, right? I mean, we've come a long way, but we've still got a long way to go, especially on the astrochemistry side. Galaxy and black hole mass assembly across cosmic time. Every time we build a new high redshift telescope, the things that people are interested in are 3 pixels across, right? That's always the way it works, right? Galactic dynamics and galactic archaeology. Galactic dynamics in the Gaia era is totally phenomenal, right? I mean, we have amazing precision now. It's just mind-blowing what we can do. And that's really taking theories of galactic dynamics to the next level. In fact, it's going to be difficult to pin down some of the particular dynamics that are going on, to be honest. And so galactic archaeology, that's another one whose time, I think, is just beginning. We have what I will call the smaller surveys, like million star surveys happening right now. And then, of course, here at the perimeter, how can I not mention fundamental physics, right? Dark energy, gravitational waves, multi-messengers, inflation constraints. We have things like SpheREx looking at the whole sky and so on. But the thing that stands out for me, right, as someone who doesn't even work in that particular area, are the possibilities over the next decade for transient and time domain astronomy. Right? And I'm saying that just, I think, from a statistical argument, that when you haven't gone and looked in a particular area in great depth, then there's all sorts of interesting things that are going to come out of it. And so in terms of the things that are influenced by wide field issues, and of course near-Earth objects, solar system, like all of the interest in what's happening at the outskirts of the solar system right now, all of these at some level or another have ramifications for wide field astronomy. So a quick comment on using facilities, right, and ideas that go into science that we do on facilities. I'm trying to break things down into two axes, whether that's completely fair. It's not a bad way to do it. So we have the quality of the idea along here and the quality of the facility there. So let's look at what we can get when we do that. When you're doing a not particularly great idea on a not particularly great facility, you might be tempted to think, well, that's not something we're interested in. But they do have a purpose, right? They can either be training projects or they could be building up data for a better project somewhere else, right? So don't dismiss them out of hand. Of course, the things that we really want are the great ideas on the best facilities. Right? No one can argue with that. That always gives you great science. Right? Unless it turns out the great idea doesn't work. And that does happen, right? Sometimes people have ideas of stacking profiles, they go off and do it, and it doesn't quite work as they'd hoped. But the other two quadrants are kind of interesting. Right, and over here, sorry, it shows up pretty well up there. So up here, when you have really good facilities with so-so ideas, then you've got the low-hanging fruit, the things that people can just think to do, write the proposal, and they go off and do them. Those things tend to get done pretty quickly on whenever new facilities are built. And then down in the bottom right, this is something that I'm acutely aware of. When you have a good idea and you do it, and then someone comes along with a bigger model or a bigger facility and does it better, right? That's really frustrating, right? So you have to make friends really quickly. I mentioned that just because I did once some simulation work looking at black hole evolution, and I thought it was a really nice way of looking at things, and everyone agreed, and of course they went off and did it better. Right. Something for anyone at PI to consider, we're looking at a huge amount of data coming into astronomy over the next 10 years. And one of the things, and this could be just me not being a good enough theorist, is I'm concerned looking at all of this whether we're going to have enough theory to explain a lot of this data. Right? And that really makes me wonder whether we're going to have a situation where we literally are data rich and theory poor. Right? This is something to think about. This is serious. I mean, potentially we may see the growth of AI methods in data analysis that actually do take us beyond this issue. But this is really concerning. Like, for example, you can think about doing these beautiful high-resolution maps of distant galaxies and the winds that are coming out of them with exquisite, very high-resolution spectroscopy, right? But if you then start asking the theorists to give you detailed predictions of what the ionization states in those winds are going to look like, that's a really hard problem to do, right? So we could well have really exquisite data, but not have good theory behind it. All right, so just a quick couple of comments on space versus ground. My colleagues in the field will like the second overhead. The obvious thing that people realize about the atmosphere is it blocks certain wavelengths of electromagnetic radiation. Right? There are, of course, certain windows that you can still do things in from the ground, optical being one, and there's a few sort of like around the near infrared and so on, and then you get back out to radio. But if you want to do X-ray, most of the infrared spectrum and then long wavelengths, you've really got to be above the atmosphere. So that's okay. But the thing that I always point out to people who ask about adaptive optics is, well, can't you correct for the atmosphere, right? And only on a small patch of sky. What is this? This is GMT. They have a fun movie of their adaptive optics laser going around. And as soon as I saw it, I couldn't resist putting a TIE fighter on it being blown up. If you've seen the EELT images, they always make the lasers unbelievably bright, right? It's ridiculously bright. They would be equivalent to like megawatt lasers, when in fact they're about 10 or 15 watts. All right, so adaptive optics won't save you for large fields, right? If you want to do large fields, optically, then you've got to be in space, really. Other than putting up with the atmospheric seeing, like we will with LSST, of course. This is why making things happen in astronomy is difficult. The Organization of Canadian Astronomy. This is a flowchart that I'm pretty sure was made by Greg Fahlman, right? That represents the way money essentially flows into the research endeavor in Canada. So it's not just money, it's facilities as well. So one of the things that theory development and observation are tied together. But we're now relying upon a lot of infrastructure that isn't just astronomy, right? So in particular, one of the reasons why I mentioned computing, right? I'm very close to that. I've been involved in Compute Canada. And I will say something about collaboration at the end there as well. I think that's important. But Compute Canada is really going to be a significant component potentially. We may be able to convince people to give us hardware for dedicated centers. I hope they do. But at the moment, at least, CADC certainly is relying upon Compute Canada. Canary, I don't have too many bad things to say about Canary by and large, although they can be very slow to help you get a new connection if you need higher bandwidth. And so CADC would probably complain about that quite significantly. But then we have NRC as an organization who has a government mandate to operate the observatories that the government of Canada is involved in. Right? So they are fundamentally involved in the research process. Canadian Space Agency, hello internet, they have an important role to play, but at the moment they essentially have almost no funding for significant investments in space astronomy. Right? This is an enormous problem for our community. Right? We literally have not got a new space astronomy mission, a truly new space astronomy mission going since 2009. Right? This is a serious, serious issue. CSA would say the follow-on to Hitomi, the failed Hitomi is a new mission, but I'd say that's a knee-jerk reaction to a very sad situation. And so we have the universities as well. We often forget that universities are paying astronomers, right? There is a lot of money there going to astronomers, and there is also a lot of research money as well from the bigger institutions especially. Right, so there's a lot of moving parts, right? CFI, NSERC, CSA, NRC, right? So in terms of building a research plan, i.e. a long-range plan, that's actually conceptually not too difficult to do, right? One of the most valuable things we do is write down a whole bunch of white papers on various research topics. Those are incredibly valuable. Thank you to everyone who worked on one, right? They really help lay out the way that we see things going. And then we have good old-fashioned town hall meetings, which sometimes are good, sometimes are bad. It depends upon what the issue is, right? I think we're getting better at handling those as a community, though, especially making sure that everyone gets heard. There may have been times in the past when that wasn't happening. And then community feedback, too. You get emails from people, right? And so I would hope that over the next few months, as we start LRP 2020, we start to have as many open conversations as possible. Personally, I do appreciate that sometimes there needs to be privacy on certain things, but I like to keep things as open as possible. And then this information feeds back into the long-range planning committee, a bunch of dedicated individuals who give a lot of their time, right, to figure out what is essentially the best idea that they can for the community as a whole. So how big is astronomy in Canada? So this is tracking that has been done for a while by ACURA, the Association for Canadian Universities for Research in Astronomy. And so we've got tenure stream, postdocs, graduate students, and undergraduate students involved in research. That's the key thing. So that's students doing honors theses or summer research projects. And so you can see there is a strong increase in the number of graduate students over time. That's probably flattened off by now. We'd like to see the new data. It's tricky why we haven't got that right now. In terms of tenure stream, that was going up, but it's kind of flattened off. Right? And in terms of postdocs, that's kind of gone up, but it hasn't got to the situation where we're one-to-one in terms of postdocs and faculty. The thing that's missing from here would be adjuncts, NRC, staff scientists, and so on. We haven't got those on the graphs there. Right? But the community is growing in terms of the graduate population significantly. So a number of the issues that have been pointed out in terms of training graduate students are critically important to our success in the future. Right? So this is something that I'm glad to say the astronomy community is dealing with, particularly in terms of looking at career paths for students as well. So this is a good change. The cost of astronomy. How much does it cost to do astronomy a year roughly in Canada? This is from 2010. The numbers for space astronomy are completely out of whack. That number includes contribution for James Webb, which was very significant in 2010 when they were still doing a lot of the FGS and NIRIS development as well. And so, well, I guess NIRIS wasn't, then it would have been TFI at that point. So $51 million for ground-based, that includes NRC contributions, that includes NSERC funds. CFI kind of goes up and down on a year-to-year basis, but there's a few million coming out of CFI for a number of important projects. So you get a total number, realistically, around $80 million a year, right? Which is a fairly significant chunk of change. But then when you start comparing it to other nations, as I was just saying to Will, why did he come to Canada, right? Then you start seeing significantly larger investments. In some cases, those are related to ESO, right? Funds that you're paying to be a member of ESO. But there are also significant investments in space-based astronomy through ESA as well. And so in particular, you look at the NASA astrophysics budget, which is enormous, right? I mean, even if we had one-tenth of that in Canada, we would be in incredibly good shape. The counter is that if you look at the US federal investment in ground-based astronomy, it's not as much as you might think, Right? So that is an interesting thing to keep in mind, and bear in mind that's obviously the issue that a lot of upfront costs in developing and building US facilities are covered by private foundations. Right, so at the end of the day, if you want to scale relative to Canada, and this was all done by GDP as well, then there's a table here. We start at 1, Australia is about 1.4, USA 2, Germany 2.1, France 2.2, Italy 2.6, and UK 2.7. Okay, but you might be saying, why isn't the government doing anything? This table doesn't matter to them. Right? Competition only matters if you care about the competition. It's an important point, right? So for the government, this kind of thing doesn't really matter to them. What they want to know is, what do they get out of putting a dollar into astronomy, right? And that is a narrative that we've not always found easy to basically come back with a good answer for, right? So beware that competitive arguments don't always play that well. So in the context of decadal plans, I'll highlight what has happened in the US. Now, the US is known for having these enormously expensive projects like Hubble. And so they get a lot of these funded basically through their decadal plans, and obviously the inspiration for Canada being organized comes partly from this too. And so the first decadal survey in 72 got Hubble. The 1982 led to Chandra, 1991 Spitzer, and Sophia. I wouldn't put the two of those in the same context, but there we go. 2001, James Webb. And then 2010, they list WFIRST. I would argue that LSST should be there as well. Right? So you can see there is a series of significant facilities that have come out of the US decadal surveys, which isn't to say there aren't more, there obviously are. So what's happened in Canada? There's an Easter egg on this one. You found it, good, okay. Bill Harris, Bill's not here, is he? Okay. There we go, okay. That's on his webpage. I didn't make that up, that's on his webpage, right? So something for the younger people, doing astronomy makes you gray, right? If you do it for long enough, that's true, whatever you do. So LRP 2000, chaired by Ralph Pudritz, McMaster. Ralph did a great job. This was a really significant step for the community, right? I can't really emphasize how much this changed the way the community was perceived by the government, right? This was incredibly impactful and it had a huge amount of success as a result of that. And we've literally been trying to recreate that success since that time. In terms of the projects that got approved, key point was entry into ALMA. And the entry into ALMA was essentially through an agreement with the US on radio astronomy, and Canada ended up building the WIDAR correlator for the JVLA. And so that was a great thing for the community. Everyone could see the value of ALMA. The one issue was everyone agreed that once we were in ALMA, we would pull out of JCMT or stop using funds for JCMT. That in the end created some problems down the road, right? Because we went from a facility that was essentially wide field to a facility that you can't really call wide field because it's an interferometer, right? Looking at very small patches of sky. So that was a significant issue. But as well as that, NGST, as it was known then, or JWST as it's known now, got its marching orders as a result of LRP 2000, and some might argue Mark Garneau's leadership at the CSA as well. And as well as that, they suggested we carry on looking at what was then called the Very Large Optical Telescope concept, which initially, many of you probably remember, some of you don't, was a 20 meter in a replacement for the CFHT dome. As well as those projects, Planck and FIRST, or FIRST became Herschel, were recommended. Obviously, two more tremendously successful things for Canada to be involved in. I've left Herschel off because I think Planck truly is wide field. And then there was a suggestion we should build an 8-meter wide field telescope. Right. I put Subaru there because everyone loves Subaru. Right? It's a great telescope. Right. So back in 2000, that was the kind of telescope the Canadian community was envisaging building. And then SKA at that time hadn't decided on baseline designs, and so this Canadian large adaptive reflector idea was out there. Really interesting idea. Floating receiver on a dirigible with 9 guide ropes. I don't know why they needed 9, but there was some argument for it. And so there were all these questions about what would happen if someone tried to shoot this down and so on, and they actually calculated it would take a long time to go down. It was all right. So anyway, a lot of discussion about that, and wide alpha JVLA. As Brian pointed out, JVLA has a reasonable field of view, right? It's not tiny. So I've mentioned Planck already, okay. So that really gets a lot of great things going. It gets significant investment from the CSA. And so 2005 midterm review, another panel of very, I can't help teasing, sorry. If you want to find pictures of Vicky on Google, lots of pictures of Vicky, right? Tremendously successful, awesome. I couldn't find a single picture of George Mitchell from SMU. So the only reason I could find a picture of George Mitchell was because I'm at St. Mary's, so I went to our archives, and we had a picture of George. So anyway, George worked in submillimeter astronomy, and he retired and went very much cold turkey. We don't see George at all. Harvey Richer. People know that? Harvey wrote a book on gold coins. By name and nature, apparently, Richer. So the other thing is, there's now the Richer Medal, so I'm wondering if his inspiration for that came from this, anyway. And Gretchen was ex officio, and of course, Ernie Sequist led this report. And so the big thing that comes out of this, right, is TMT gets elevated to a high priority, right? Because now we essentially have the merging of VLIT and KELP projects. And the wide field implications are, let's get rid of the 8-meter, right? Because we need to push for TMT. And so we move on to LRP 2010, another panel of not so gray people this time, right? So, and charged with forging the picture from 2010 to 2020. Oh my God, it's 2018. This feels like yesterday. So led by Chris Pritchett, really kind of an interesting situation for wide field. I mean, there wasn't too much to really get into the details on TMT and SKA. Those were reaffirmed as 1 and 2 priorities. When things take 20 years to build, not a whole lot's going to change in your long-range plans from 5 to 10-year timescales. But what we did do was focus strongly on the fact that wide-field imaging from space really was a key science area. And even at that time, although we called it dark energy, everyone was aware that the reality was we really wanted that wide-field imaging for all of the cool science we were going to do on galaxies, galaxy clusters, and so on. Right? So although a dark energy mission was listed, nonetheless, we were acutely aware at that time that we were focused on much other science as well. So that includes the Euclid mission, WFIRST, and at the time what was called the Canadian Space Telescope, which of course became CASTOR. As well as that, CHIME. When we saw CHIME, we were like, how come this isn't approved already? This looks like a really good project. And there were all of these question marks about the hardware side and the software development side. But we felt, look, this looks like something that is a match made in heaven in terms of Canadian expertise. So we got behind it and gave it a very high ranking. And it's awesome to see it built. It really is, right? And it's a fantastic facility and a great piece of Canadian ingenuity. I mean, it's amazing that we're already saying that, and as people are saying, there aren't really very many science papers out at all. So anyway, NGCFHT concept comes along as well, somewhat towards the end of the process. But at that time, people are starting to see that the whole issue of wide-field multi-object spectroscopy is really becoming a big issue, right? But one of the things that was interesting that we had an open discussion about was whether something like DESI should go on CFHT, but there was general agreement at the time that that just wasn't really practical. And if you wanted to do interesting science, then you've really got to start going out to bigger depths and into the halo, right? And you need 10-meter class telescopes to do that. So we didn't get completely behind this at the time. We strongly recommended it for further study because it was strongly felt that there was more study that was needed and that would strengthen the proposal in general. So MTR 2015, swear the people are getting younger. Well, David gave us some gray. Okay, so I'd love to sort of stand here and tell you that these incredibly different things happened as a part of MTR 2015, but the reality is we pretty much went with what had been laid out in LRP 2010. What did change was access to wide field space imaging missions, dark energy missions, call them what you want. There, the situation was that Euclid, we were cut out at the hardware level on Euclid. We still have gained some entry into Euclid via CFIS, so that is not so much of a concern, but there's still no major hardware contribution. WFIRST, as many of you are aware, that has essentially gone away because the integral field channel was essentially de-scoped by NASA following the Canadian Space Agency saying, no, we can't do it. There's no money. That's been a little bit of embarrassing for us as a community. Not clear what the ramifications of that are going to be down the road. But of course, CASTOR is still standing, right? And is a really interesting idea. And I love how the science case for that has developed over the last 2 years at least anyway. Thinking about all of the standalone science in particular makes it really good. The other irony is, now that WFIRST has lost the integral field channel, right, CASTOR is already looking like a lot stronger compared to that as well. So CASTOR really is a great mission with a lot of potential for Canadian leadership. The question is, can we come up with the funds for something like that? Right? Because one of the key things that we're looking at is we aren't the only people who want a lot of money for space. We're going to be competing against other technologies like synthetic aperture radar missions, new Canadarm missions for the Lunar Gateway and things like that. So we really need to have really polished economic implications arguments for those things. But I think there's hope. There really is. So I want someone to correct me if I'm wrong on this. So in terms of actual facilities that anyone in Canada can write a proposal to get time on for wide field, I think these are the only two. There's a hell of a lot of other wide field things we're involved in, but in terms of things that people can write proposals for, I think these are the only two. Am I wrong? Okay, sure. Via other routes, absolutely, yeah. Okay, but if you look at all of the other things that are wide field that we're involved in, such as experiments or things that we're involved in through the gracious agreements of Dunlap, for example, for LSST, right, and universities funding individual researchers, then the situation is very different, and of course, CFIS given access for Euclid, right? But this highlights how things have changed, right? That now we're seeing a lot of these, I don't want to call them smaller, because in many cases, they're not necessarily smaller. Dragonfly is just fantastic, right? The one thing that disturbs you about Dragonfly is when you hear MPs talking about that, they go, oh, does that mean we don't need those big telescopes anymore? Right? So it's fun. But anyway, Dragonfly has done some amazing science. And I have to say, I love Dragonfly because it found galaxies that I was writing papers about in 2000. It's like, yay! Okay. CHIME, obviously we've talked about that. CHIME is just fantastic. MWA, again, U of T, is involved in MWA, Euclid through CFIS, LSST. I'm sure there are other things as well, ASCAP and so on. So there are a lot of things that we're involved in, as Brian was talking about. Right? So this is a really amazing situation that we've gone from looking at the facility viewpoint to getting involvement at the individual, institutional, or group level. So in the international context, the key facility for me is LSST. I find it massively ironic that I am some kind of LSST champion. It's just an incredible facility. And if I'm completely honest, as I said this morning, I won't go through that. I think one of the big missteps in LRP 2010, and I'll call it a feature, I won't call it a failure, that we didn't push people on LSST involvement in then. And I think that's partly down to the fact that we all presumed that the data would essentially be free, right? That it would just be processed and released the same way we envisage a lot of the European missions. But of course, that's not true. Each different science area has its own data release policies. Of course, there will be alerts and so on that everyone hears about, et cetera. But that was really essentially a failure of ours because we just weren't involved enough in it at the time, right? And so when it came to finding someone who would champion it, people were like, yeah, sorry, I'm concerned about something else I'm doing on CFHT and so on. And so we never really got going with that, right? Even though from a time domain perspective, you've probably all seen that big sort of like timescale versus magnitude chart where they have all of the different things that you can detect. And then there's that big question mark for what LSST will start to uncover. I mean, it's incredible when you think 15 seconds, 2 second read, 15 seconds, another exposure, right? That's pretty mind blowing, right? On a camera like that. So it's gonna do some incredible things. Now, it could be, of course, that it doesn't find a lot of new great stuff. I don't believe that for a second, right? I'm pretty much convinced that even when you factor in all of the amazing stuff it's going to do looking at non-transients, right, 840 million objects every 3 days, right, it's going to be a really amazing treasure trove. So what about CFHT in the current context? Of course, now we have Spirou. Right, I was just up there. They actually let me up there, and it's still working when I left. Right, so this is going to do some really interesting science. It probably has a somewhat limited lifetime in terms of what it can do. Right, there is competition as well, Carmines and so on. But this is really good science that's getting on the telescope now. Right, as well as that, of course, CFHT is still competitive in U-band. Right. We've got a number of projects like CFIS and so on, also CFIS-I as well, if I remember correctly. And then there's Clouds 2 supporting Hybrid SupremeCam as well. So there are still things that we can do. It's just pushing us more and more and more and more into those niches, and the lifetime of where what we can do with that is limited. So next generation space-based imaging, Euclid, WFIRST, again, sold both as dark energy missions, but really wide field imaging from space. But CASTA, right, this is something that we really could do, right, if we can get the money, right? That is going to be the question. Now, I know that there are some people who feel it's aperture limited, but I don't think in this particular case, if we look carefully enough at the science cases, that's a fair criticism, right? If you look at Messier, for example, you could say, well, that's a 40 centimeter telescope, right? Because of pupil design, there's no reason why we couldn't have something that gives this beautiful diffraction-limited imaging across the whole focal plane at the same level, right? TMA design. So this could actually be a really great project for Canada. In context of leadership, if nothing else flies in that space for a long time, then it is the leader for a long time, right? One of the key things in all of this is, if you go into an area that no one else is in, by definition, right, you are leading that area. You can do what you want. You can do great PI science as well as survey science if you want to, right? So there is a lot of potential here if we can convince people of that, right? And selling CASTA is going to be the biggest problem we face if we as a community chose that that's the direction we have to go, right? Or the direction we want to go is what I should say. So as I mentioned earlier, there are a number of other projects from other fields that are competing for the money for space projects, right? But I think this is definitely something that we can do and make a really fantastic job of doing. Wide field spectroscopy, VLT moons and PFS. This is actually one of the key things coming along in the next 2 years. Moons is interesting, goes out deep into the halo. PFS, very low resolution, just essentially focused, I would argue, on the cosmology side of things. For the people who are not astronomers, one of the key things that I love about this wide field spectroscopy is being able to trace stars and relate those to previous generations of emerging galaxies. There is this whole idea of, it's a terrible phrase, but it's called galactic cannibalism. The galaxies grow by eating other galaxies. This is an Elsie Starkenberg's from 2009. This is an overestimate of the actual amount of substructure we would expect to see, right? But being able to look at the current halo and then trace back all of these streams, look at the types of stars, their actual chemical fingerprints, and so on, this is something that we really can hope to do to a great deal of precision with 10-meter class telescopes. And so just one fun little bit. When I explain galaxy formation and evolution to the public, I like to use the analogy that it's a giant blender. And so what something looking at galactic archaeology when we try and separate all of those streams is doing is trying to unblend something.
Blender. I'm going to press the starting bell button.
It's the iPhone. So you're asking, what's the connection? It was a Samsung Galaxy. I'm English, I can't help it, sorry. Okay, so I use that for a lot of public outreach, and it always gets a good laugh. Not a BlackBerry, no. We'd never blend a BlackBerry in, waddle it. All right, so the Mauna Kea Spectroscopic Explorer is currently down to be the follow-on telescope for CFHT. If redevelopment happens on the CFHT site, there's a number of issues, obviously, with the 30-meter telescope that, to a certain extent, have to be resolved first. The situation for redevelopment of CFHT is different to TMT, but that's a very long conversation, and we don't want to talk about that. But what I really love about MSC is how it's starting to really gain traction in a number of different communities. Right? Particularly, I love how the Americans are looking at it now. And so with the Americans coming up to their decadal planning, I grabbed this from Jeff Newman. And so here's a comparison. And as many of you people are aware, there are a number of very influential reports commenting that to support LSST, a large-scale, wide-field spectroscopic instrument is needed in the South. Right, so they're thinking about this extensively in the US community. The same thing is true of ESO and the Australians. Everyone is interested in this. And so when you look at the actual design parameters for doing, I guess this is just follow-up stuff on LSST, photos are used and so on. But then once you start including an 8,000 square degree halo survey or a 20K degree halo survey as well, MSC stands out, right? It's the best facility. Right. And I think that's a really key thing for the main reason that when you get into a situation where everyone is going to be competing in this space, because it's pretty clear that MSC probably won't be the only thing that gets built, then having this tremendous survey advantage is going to be a big part of making MSC a success. You can always start doing the conversation about, is it better in the South? Is it better in the North? Let's not do that right now. I haven't mentioned radio hardly at all. The radio situation is will change massively with SKA, right? It's changing a lot already with things like MWA and so on. In terms of the multi-wavelength issue, that's a problem that I'm going to love to see what comes out of LRP 2020 on that, right? Bringing together these things, for me as a theorist, I mean, I've loved this in terms of what I've got out of radio for my AGN modeling. Right, but I want to see where we go with this in LRP 2020 of how we can start coordinating these things. I mean, SKA, I don't have any... The biggest problem with SKA, in my opinion, is the whole treaty issue. I think that will be solved. The government clearly likes it from a technology development perspective, and so I think this is something that really does cross a lot of T's and dot a lot of I's for the government. So I'm really confident in SKA. So just to wrap up, I've got 4 minutes left, some thoughts on planning. One of the key things, as I mentioned, we are a small community, right? 170 faculty members across the country, right? I mean, compare that to a Caltech, for example, astronomy, right? So the opportunity cost of not getting things right is particularly large for us, right? And that's something to remember, right? If we get things wrong with a long-range plan, we can have a long time trying to get things back where they are. So one of the key points of the long-range plan really was protecting against that by focusing on the big-ticket items, the things that we really have to go to the government to get funding for, right? I'm not averse to having a survey strategy for Canada, right? But the thing I'll say about that is, if you're going to have a strategy and national coordination, it has to be completely genuine, right? Why am I saying this? Because Compute Canada is an example of something where people were told to collaborate but didn't really want to, right? And it was a mess for 15 years. It's still a mess, right? I'm being harsh, but it's a reality, right? There is a lot of tension in that organization because people were brought together who weren't natural collaborators. I think we can be better than that as a community. For what it's worth, I love representing the astronomy community, right? Because I think we do actually all pull together. I mean, the worst emails I got from people who were disagreeing about MTR 2015 stuff, we're still talking. I'm not standing here in riot gear, right? So I think as a community we can do this, but I do want to emphasize this has to be genuine. And the other thing is, with surveys, especially once we start building complicated interrelationships between surveys, you don't want to create something that's basically going to fall apart once you pull something out of the bottom, right? So that's something to remember as well. Oh, in selling a long-range plan, just some comments now from... I talked to MPs both in Halifax. I have a number of friends who are MPs in Nova Scotia. And so we naturally, as scientists, are taught to dismiss the anecdote, right? But for most people, not all, for most people, they are actually extremely powerful, right? And so the cliched policy advice is the policymakers, the deputy ministers, the people who are there to support the MP, are the people who really care about that precisely detailed information, right? So if you ask who's reading the long-range plan other than the astronomers, the deputy ministers, or assistant deputy ministers, as the case may be. MPs, not to discredit MPs in any way, there are some very brilliant MPs who I've met and I have a lot of respect for, still want human stories, right? Because those stories, storytelling is a big part of politics if you watch it. So you need both to craft an effective pitch. And the thing that I talked about this morning, right, in terms of HQP, was that people really matter. The outcomes of the personnel in astronomy are as important as the facilities we build, right? And the good thing is, I think we're finally getting our heads around that. It's taken a while, right? But our culture is changing. Our approaches to training are changing as well. So that's really important, right? One of the most damaging things that you can have is people leaving astronomy because they literally don't want to be in it, right? Now, I understand there's always going to be competition, right? And we need to make people aware that there is competition. So with my own graduate students, I try to make it clear what the kind of competition is so they come into it knowing that, right? But we are there to support them and we are there to give them skills that are transferable as well. And so the last thing I'll say, personal stories that connect both to economic and social benefits are incredibly powerful, right? If you can come up with a story, particularly the ones that really do sell, are the stories of the entrepreneur who comes out of astronomy, applies their particular camera technology, develops a new camera, and so on. Right? Those are beautiful stories that people love to hear about and really do sell us the way we want to be sold. All right, perfectly on time, there we go, okay. So huge thank you to Perimeter for hosting us this week. It's amazing to see this building up close, and let's have a great few days. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Rob. That was great. Political overview of the landscape.
Yep.
Questions?
I'm curious if you have any advice in terms of, you were talking there about how to sell a long-range plan, but what about how to put the long-range plan together in terms of your experience with the MTR and previous LRP? Anything you would recommend in terms of the types of...
Repeat the question. So the question is, do I have any advice on actually doing a long-range plan in terms of setting up the personnel that are involved? Obviously, like, breadth of knowledge is a key factor. But then having people who are well-connected is an important factor as well, but not to the point where you get someone who agrees with everyone. You have to have people who are prepared to disagree. But in terms of actually building the decisions itself, it is a synthesis process, right? I mean, potentially we could have something like what happened with WFIRST in the US decadal, where a high-level committee essentially said, why don't we just merge this and build a new thing? But it's not clear that in Canada we've ever had an opportunity for that kind of vision on something. But I would love it if that happened. That would be a huge leadership thing to do. And then we would obviously have to have a circular... a distribution of a draft for comment or something like that. But I'm pretty confident that we have enough people to build I know we have enough people to build a really good committee. Right? It's just making sure we have the right personality mix. And one of the things that we do is work with the chairs to build a committee of people that they're happy to work with. Right? That is a key point. I mean, you do need a blend of abilities. You need a blend of people who are prepared to go off and do, in some cases, a lot of work. Right? You don't want people on there who, ironically like me now, have no time for doing anything. Right? They need to be able to go off and do stuff.
Quick comment, which is that a number of times, including in your talk, we've talked about space, we've talked about difficulties we have dealing with that at the CSA. I just wanted to remind everybody that there is a space astronomy meeting, yep, sort of like this one, happening in early November in Montreal.
And so just so people know, so the Coalition for Canadian Astronomy submits a pre-budget document basically trying to shore up LRP requests, push the government on these things. It's a short sort of like two-page document. It's always limited. And so in that document, we took the position that the key thing for us is having money for space astronomy missions. Right? We didn't actually push on one particular project in this case, but there's clearly an enormous problem, right? Whether you're doing far infrared, optical, whatever, there is a huge problem with money, and so that's what we pushed on. And a number of other communities are doing that as well. Oh, sure. That is a long way back. Hold on. Yes. Okay, so the question is, can we simplify this diagram? Right? How would I organize the funding of Canadian astronomy if I could? I find this frustrating, right? CFI and NSERC, they're created for two different political endeavors, which is why they exist. We can work with it, right? But nonetheless, a stronger connection between CFI and NSERC, particularly as has been repeated time and again. We tend to be somewhat rich on capital expenditures, but on the operational expenditures, we're poor. We always struggle. And so you end up essentially wondering how you are going to trade off your operational expenses. Most of our operational expenses, like for Gemini, CFHT, are coming through NRC. Right, through international telescope agreements. Right? So if we could connect these two together somehow in a more sort of like holistic vision for how projects are managed, that would be a great help. But NSERC is in the middle of creating, NSERC, the tri-councils are in the middle of creating new funds. I mean, never complain about money, but it creates organizational headaches sometimes. So that we can simplify somewhat. The whole issue of NRC and CSA. CSA, it's not that space projects can't be funded by another route. Technically, you could get CFI money to do something in space. But in practice, these are the people who work with all of the contractors and so on. So in practice, most of the money funnels through the CSA. It would be terrific if we could have space astronomy within the NRC, in my opinion. Right? That would help us, but that's not, again, politically allowed right now. Right? They are separate agencies, although they would like to work together on some things. Right? So I would like to do that. I don't have a problem with government sort of input, government laboratory, if you want to call it that, input into astronomy. I think that's useful. And I think to a large extent, a number of the big operational things can only be really done by government labs. Right? We could have situations, for example, one of the things that's been floated is contracting out the management of HAA. Right? But there's no real appetite for that anymore, because what would really happen is you would take the people at the highest levels, take them out of being government employees, employ them as contractors, and then put them back in those roles. It's just not too much point in doing that. You could have perhaps better oversight, but the good thing is, as many of you are likely aware, there is now a new HAA advisory body being built as we speak. So that's going to be a better connector between the universities and HAA. So I would like to do essentially the same thing, like just bring down the level of complexity there. It makes it easier for us in terms of like who we have to talk to, right? And to be fair, CSA does not have anywhere near close to the engineering and scientific expertise that NRC has for astronomy, right? They do have some astronomers on staff, but it's a skeleton crew of people, right? And it's arguably representative of how much funding they have. Sorry, I do short answers as well.
Just to back to you.
Yep.
Imagine it's the end of the LRP. We make the recommendation, which I think I've heard 5 or 6 times already, which is funding.
Yep.
I'm very optimistic and have a lot of energy. Do we think anyone is going
Okay, you should be worried. That's completely reasonable.
So
the question is, how are we really going to sell this issue that we need more money for operations? It's not us. More money for operations, it depends entirely what the class of people doing those operations are. If they're technicians, it's different from postdocs. We have a tendency in a small community to use postdocs as technicians, which, as Dustin commented, is not necessarily a good career path. And I know that, having almost gone through that myself, but deciding not to. My own view on that is, if we have a situation where those people do have an obvious career path, such as going through NRC, right, with a larger operational budget or something like that, then I think that's okay. Right? But at the moment, we need to create the understanding in government that we don't have enough OPEX for all the CAPEX that we've been able to generate. And so my own opinion on that is, at the moment, that needs to go through the Office of the Minister for Science, because that's where we're going to have biggest impact on that. I don't know what to say, because we've been complaining about this for 15 years. Right? And it's a challenge. And it may be that is what the government wants. I mean, there is sometimes, certainly with conservative governments, there is a viewpoint that you should have this kind of Machiavellian pyramid, right? But we as a community don't like that. We want people to have alternatives for what they can do with their careers, right? And so we are changing, though, in terms of the kind of training we provide. I mean, it's amazing for me seeing my graduate students come out and now just going off and working on data science or something like that and getting, like, I won't say they're better paid than I am, but they're starting on great salaries. And that's awesome, and they're really enjoying it. So that's great. right? And there's a nice, beautiful change there. But in terms of convincing people, we just have to keep saying the right message and just keep pointing this out. And I think personal stories, like Dustin's, are a powerful part of that message. Yep. Okay, so this is a great question, actually. So the question is, what efforts have been done in Canada to raise private funds for supporting astronomy, the development of astronomy facilities? And the answer is, there have been a few small successful efforts, but at least for the moment, we don't have, the Trottier Foundation would be a good example in Montreal. Dunlap is another example of donor money as well. So it is there, but there's nothing quite like the Keck Foundation or Moore Foundation in Canada. I think, honestly, when you think about what happens in the US versus what happens to Canada, I always work by powers of 10, right? So if someone in the US gets $100 million, then we can expect to get a $10 million donation. And if you go and look, there are $10 million donations happening, but they tend to be for things like the Art McDonald Gray Professorship and things like that. And so we're not getting a lot of money coming in. I know Brian, is Brian here? Brian McNamara? No. So Brian did look into raising private capital quite extensively as part of LRPIC about 2 or 3 years ago, but nothing that I'm aware of really came out of that. He did speak to a lot of advisors and so on. I mean, it would be great. It would be great if we could do that, but I haven't seen anything successful. That doesn't mean we shouldn't keep trying at that sort of really high level anyway.